Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, "We are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with, and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better." It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnson.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, Lake City, Florida, and the rest of humanity living on the planet Earth who are listening via live streaming. This is Chris Arnson, your host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, wishing you a happy Good Friday on this 14th day of April 2017. We are supposed to be interviewing Jerry Bergman today, Dr. Jerry Bergman, who is an author, including the book that we are supposed to be addressing today, How Darwinism Corrodes Morality, but we have not yet heard from Dr. Bergman for some reason, so I'm going to go to a early station break, and if you could be patient while we try to locate Dr. Bergman, that would be very much appreciated. And if you'd like to join us on the air with a question about Darwinian evolution and how Darwinianism, or should I say Darwinism, corrodes morality, you can email us at chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com, that's chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And give us a question, and please include your first name, city and state, and country of residence. We'll be right back after these messages, hopefully, with Dr. Bergman.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnson, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, here to tell you about an exciting offer from World Magazine, my trusted source for news from a Christian perspective. Try World at no charge for 90 days and get a free copy of R.C. Sproul's book, Relationship Between Church and State. I rely on World because I trust the reporting. I gain insight from the analysis. And World provides clarity to the news stories that really matter. I believe you'll also find World to be an invaluable resource to better understand critical topics with a depth that's simply not found in other media outlets. Armed with this coverage, World can help you to be a voice of wisdom in your family and your community. This trial includes bi-weekly issues of World Magazine, on-scene reporting from World Radio, and the fully shareable content of World Digital. Simply visit wmg.org/ironsharpens to get your world trial and Dr. Sproul's book all free. No obligation with no credit card required. Visit World News Group at wmg.org/ironsharpens today.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Iron Sharpens Iron Radio is sponsored by Harvey Cedars, a year-round Bible conference and retreat center nestled on the Jersey Shore. Harvey Cedars offers a wide range of accommodations to suit groups up to 400. For generations, Christians have enjoyed gathering and growing at Harvey Cedars. Each year, thousands of high school and college students come and learn more about God's Word. An additional 9,000 come annually to Harvey Cedars as families, couples, singles, men, women, pastors, seniors, and missionaries. 90 miles from New York City, 70 miles from Philly, and 95 miles from Wilmington, and easily accessible, scores of notable Christian groups frequently plan conferences at Harvey Cedars, like the Navigators, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, Campus Crusade, and the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. Find Harvey Cedars on Facebook or at hcbible.org, hcbible.org. Call 609-494-5689, 609-494-5689. Harvey Cedars, where Christ finds people and changes lives.
Every day at thousands of community centers, high schools, middle schools, juvenile institutions, coffee shops, and local hangouts, Long Island Youth for Christ staff and volunteers meet with young people who need Jesus. We are rural and urban, and we are always about the message of Jesus. Our mission is to have a noticeable spiritual impact on Long Island, New York by engaging young people in the lifelong journey of following Christ. Long Island Youth for Christ has been a stalwart bedrock ministry since 1959. We have a world-class staff and a proven track record of bringing consistent love and encouragement to youths in need all over the country and around the world. Help honor our history by becoming a part of our future. Volunteer, donate, pray, or all of the above. For details, call Long Island Youth for Christ at 631-385-8333. That's 631-385-8333. Or visit liyfc.org. That's liyfc.org.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ
in fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bob Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402. Or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
Chef Exclusive Catering is in South Central Pennsylvania. Chef Exclusive's goal is to provide a dining experience that is sure to please any palate. Chef Damian White of Chef Exclusive is a graduate of the renowned Johnson & Wales University with a degree in culinary arts and applied science. Chef Exclusive Catering's event center is newly designed with elegance and style and is available for small office gatherings, bridal showers, engagement parties, and rehearsal dinners. Critics and guests alike acknowledge Chef Exclusive's commitment to exceeding even the highest expectations. I know of their quality firsthand since Chef Exclusive catered my most recent Iron Sharpens Iron Radio Pastor's Luncheon. For details, call 717-388-3000. That's 717-388-3000. Or visit chefexclusive.com. That's chefexclusive.com.
Welcome back, and I believe we do have Dr. Jerry Bergman on the air. Dr. Jerry Bergman has 9 degrees, including 7 graduate degrees, has studied for his past college work in biology, chemistry, psychology, and evaluation and research, a prolific writer and teacher of biology, chemistry, and biochemistry at Northwest State in Archbold, Ohio, and he's discussing his book, How Darwinism Corrodes Morality, And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you for the very first time to Iron Sharpens Iron, Dr. Jerry Bergman.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And sorry for the confusion. I don't know what has happened with the miscommunication, but I'm glad that we were having God smile upon us today, and He worked things out.
Okay, that's good.
Yes. First of all, before I even get into the subject of Darwinism and the book, I want to get some background from you. I want to hear about how you were raised, what kind of religious background you were from, if any, and how our Sovereign Lord eventually, through His providence, drew you to Himself and saved you.
Yeah, the important thing in my life was, partially my background, of course. My father was an atheist, and my mother was, well, she switched back and forth to several different faiths, but developed Alzheimer's relatively early, and so there wasn't a lot of background there. But the main thing that drew me away from Darwinism, I was at one time an atheist as well as my dad, and that was a lot to do with the influence of education. I was a science major for many of my degrees, and when you study science, basically the background of science is Darwinism, and I naively accepted that. And as time went on, though, I began to question it more and more and realize that there are big problems with Darwinism. And when you realize that, you realize that if Darwinism doesn't explain how we got here, then what does? You really only have two choices. Either we were made by God, intelligent designer, or we were made by time, chance, unforeseen occurrence. In other words, survival of the fittest, as evolution teaches. So when I remove one possibility, there was really only one basic one left. And that was, indeed, we have a designer. And then my feeling was I have an obligation to find out who that designer is. And, of course, I explored different traditions. And the main one that I explored, as others have as well, by the way, there are many people who have gone around the same path that I did, and I explored the evidence, and, of course, the scriptures clearly show the evidence of so many, many ways that indeed is the Word of God, and indeed following that Word of God leads me into Christianity, and basically it's like going over a dam. You move more and more toward the end of the dam, and finally the evidence piles up so high that you fall over the dam, and this is called, of course, in Christian terms, is called being born again. So you make that commitment, you make that jump, and indeed I did that. But as a result of, in my case, and many cases, a lot of study, research, and reading, I did not have a Pauline on the road to Damascus experience. Some people do, but from people I know, I find most people don't. They basically become convinced because of the evidence. And, of course, the scriptures do talk about the importance of the evidence and the importance of being able to defend the faith that is within us. And, therefore, I stress, since my conversion, I stress and still stress today, apologetics. That, indeed, apologetics, understanding the evidence for Christianity, is the key way most of us become convinced of, indeed, the reality of Christ and His sacrifice for us, and the basic Christian message.
Well, praise God for that testimony. It's refreshing to hear that science actually led you to believe in a creator, and eventually the Lord used that to bring you to your knees and cry out to Jesus Christ for your eternal life. And the reason why I'm saying how refreshing that is obviously we have heard stories about many folks, perhaps especially young people, who in either high school or college may begin their entrance into school as Bible believers because of their upbringing. They may even be young earth creationists, and they leave school being Darwinians. They totally abandon what they were raised with, because they believe that Darwinism is the only intellectual, sophisticated, scientific, and true explanation for the origins of the Earth. And it's absolutely amazing to me how this has become, the origin of the species has become basically the Bible of so many scientists, when Darwin himself wasn't really an accomplished scientist, was he?
Well, no, he wasn't. In fact, his only degree was in theology, and he did a lot of experiments, but he did experiments on things like worms and insects that are consumed by plants, the Venus flytrap, for example, and so he did some experiments, but none of his experiments really helped support his basic idea of Darwinism. And we call it Darwinism today, by the way, because he wasn't the one who totally originated the theory. He basically was the one who was able to convince the scientific world, or much of the scientific world, that indeed his idea of the origin of species is true. And basically, to review what Darwinism is, Darwin recognized correctly that there's a great deal of variety in the natural world. And then he said, well, some of that variety produces an animal or plant that's superior to others, and that superior animal is more likely to survive and propagate its kind. Those inferior animals are less likely to be able to propagate their kind. The whole problem with that is not natural selection. The whole problem is what they call not survival of the fittest, but the arrival of the fittest. And Darwin was not able to explain that, and today we have the same problem. We're trying to explain scientists, they're trying to explain evolutionists specifically, are trying to explain the arrival of the fittest. The only theory they've come up with that explains it, or at least they think it does, is mutations. And the whole problem with mutations is the vast majority are either near neutral, which means they're not lethal, but they accumulate and cause a problem in the long run, or they're deleterious, they're harmful. And so how in the world do you get evolution when the vast majority of mutations are not beneficial, but slightly deleterious, slightly harmful, or in a major way harmful? What happens is evolution is not going forward, it's going backward. And that's really recognized in the area I teach, for example, in medicine. We know that the accumulation of mutations is going up with each generation. In fact, my biochemistry book says after each generation, a child has about 100 more mutations than his or her parents. And then that child's child will have 100 more still. So what we see is the accumulation of mutations through each generation, and that leads up to what they call mutational meltdown. And never going to get us to evolution. It's not going the right way. And you just look at the evidence, which is very clear, and you can see that indeed the evidence is not that we're getting better and better with each generation. We're not evolving, but we're de-evolving, which interestingly, of course, the scriptures talk about. Adam and Eve being perfect, and since then sin entered into the world, and as a result the mutational load is increasing in each generation, and that's exactly what we see in science.
Now, was Darwin a theistic evolutionist, or did he become an atheist? What were his views of God and so on?
Well, his views on God changed a little bit. When he was younger, of course, he went to seminary and wanted to become a priest, I should say, a minister in the Anglican Church. And he, when pressed on this, he wavered back and forth. Problem is when he was alive, his wife was a devout Christian, his family was very involved in the church, his neighbors, his friends, many were very involved in the church and therefore had at least outward a show of Christianity. And so he was a good politician. One might, you know, condemn him for his ideas, but on the other hand, he was a good politician, and he recognized you don't want to call yourself an atheist. He once said that he never was a full atheist, but when you read his ideas, he, for example, said that atheism must explain everything, and theism must not enter at all into his theory. And so when people said, well, maybe God intervened to create man, he couldn't accept that. His co-worker, Wallace, accepted, basically, realized that there's no way that man could evolve, and therefore Wallace felt that God intervened in the creation of man. Well, Darwin was upset with that, and that basically severed their previously good relationship. And Darwin basically said, there's no way I can accept God as having any effect at all in the origin of life and humans especially. So belief-wise, I guess you'd have to say he was an atheist, but he wouldn't label himself that way. He would probably label himself an agnostic, but in many ways I think he was wavering. He was just, you know, trying to please the public. He was trying to be a good politician, as we know now from politicians. They tend to say what they need to get elected, and then when they get elected, they do what they want to. Some do, at least. And we can say the same thing is true with Charles Darwin. He said what he needed to sell books, and he indeed sold lots of books. And within a few years, like 20 years, he converted most scientists to the evolutionary worldview. But there's always been holdouts. There's always been scientists then and today that recognize you'll never get humans from lots of mistakes. If you look at humans, what they believe were the results of billions of mistakes. Well, I don't buy that, and you don't either, I know. And evolutionists, yet they have to admit that's really what they teach, that we're the result of billions of mistakes, and that when you put it that way, it doesn't make sense. And the way Darwin put it, of course, it does make much more sense, but then he was a good politician and tactful and knew what to say to sell his ideas. And he really thought he was selling his ideas. When he convinced somebody, he called them converts. He says, well, we'll keep working on so-and-so, and when they finally accept the Darwinian worldview, he'd say, well, we've got a convert now. So he converted them to our cause. So he was really active in proselytizing, and I must add, very effective in proselytizing, and that's one reason we call his theory Darwinism instead of Lamarckianism or some other name.
Now, if you could, this may seem like a silly question because of the way that evolution and Darwinism has really infiltrated society globally from our youngest years of childhood. But if you could, just to prevent anybody from having any kind of a caricature of what Darwinian evolution really means, if you could give us a summary of what Darwin actually meant by evolution and what is the theory that is predominantly held today by scientists who are Darwinian.
Well, the theory is best described by a cliche, which may seem humorous, but it really is what they believe, and that is evolution is from the goo, which is the original matter which they believe evolved into cells, from the goo to you by way of the zoo. That's what they teach. From the goo to you by way of the zoo. And that's really what they, that's basically it.
And that basically that we can trace, although they have no evidence of this, that they believe that man basically has ancestors that are traced all the way back to pond scum, as the old saying goes. Is that actually true, what they believe?
That's the goo. And they recognize, many scientists today, that that's just not viable, that there's no way, given the conditions on the Earth, there's no way you're going to form cells purely by spontaneous generation and time and chance and mutations and so on. And so now a more and more common theory is basically that we evolved from life which came from outer space. In fact, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who did the film Cosmos, which is a tremendously successful film, had a huge budget. Basically, he spends a good deal of one part of one film arguing that life came from the stars. And, of course, that begs the question, well, how did it get to the stars? I mean, if we can't explain the origin of life on the Earth, how are you going to explain the origin somewhere else, some other planet, some unknown XYZ planet somewhere out near other stars? And he's really struggling to come up with an explanation for the origin of life, and that doesn't solve the problem. It just moves it somewhere else. Instead of spontaneously originating on Earth, which is what they believe, then it spontaneously originated somewhere else. But why do we think that somewhere else is more habitable and more commensurate with the origin of life? Well, we don't. So what we're doing is speculating about possibility of life or originating somewhere else that we really have no idea where. And we can speculate, billion light years away it evolved, but we really can't explain it there as well. And we know that of the planets we've discovered, and we've discovered quite a few now, of the planets we discovered, the only one that we know of that's hospitable toward life is, of course, the Earth. And no other planet we know of is hospitable to life. The planets are either too large, too small, too close to the sun, too far away, or we don't understand the conditions that are there to determine whether or not they're hospitable to life. And I don't think they're going to find any planets that are, but, scientists are spending money looking, and to me that just moves the problem somewhere else. It doesn't solve it. But they realize they've got a conundrum. How do you get from organic matter, from molecules, how do you get that to the cell? The cell, as we know, of course, is the most complex machine in the universe. And as such, how are you going to get from a bunch of, of goo, the cells? They don't have any idea. And they admit, most scientists admit, if they study this, that indeed we have no idea. Well, that forces us to believe there must be an intelligent creator that indeed created the first cell, created all life, and that's really the only logical explanation that we have.
Now, the thing that is fascinating about this, fascinating and disturbing, is that you have those who claim to be the true intelligentsia of science, the true elite, the true scientists, are those who claim Darwinianism as their theory for the origins of life, and yet there is no scientific evidence to back up what they say, and the observable science, when you have experiments that can be reproduced and so on, all of that seems to point towards creationism and the fact that there is intelligent design. It seems very bizarre. To me, it's very reflective of ancient Roman Catholicism, where you had the Roman Catholic Church severely punishing individuals for believing in things that they discovered through science, and because it violated a Catholic teaching that was not even biblical, or was not even the result of accurate biblical exegesis. They were really superstitions or myths that the Catholic Church believed. Yeah. And they would censor or punish people who disagreed with them. And of course, we have Copernicus and Galileo and people like that that were rebuked by Rome and censored and so on for their beliefs. And today, it seems you have a reversal of things where you have the scientific world acting like a religious totalitarian entity, where it doesn't matter if you can prove us wrong, you better not say what you believe, or we will ruin your career, we will get you fired, we will prevent you from being hired, you'll be a laughing stock in the scientific community for believing what you believe, even though we can never, in any stretch of the imagination, prove what we believe.
Yeah, that reminds me of my book I wrote not too long ago, just published actually a few months ago, called Silencing the Darwin Skeptics. And I show indeed that that's exactly what's happening. And I've been interested very much in eugenics and in the application of Darwinism to society. And, of course, the best example of that is Hitler and Hitler's persons that went with him. And in studying that, in fact, my book, How Darwinism Corrodes Morality, which, of course, Master Books, New Leaf Press, published, one thing I stress in there, indeed, is the fact that, indeed, Darwinism has affected our morals, our moral values. In fact, the other book, The Darwin Effect, which I also take this theme and carry this through, Darwin Effect was published by Master Books, I'm sorry. Darwinism Corrodes Morality was published by another publisher.
Joshua Press.
Joshua Press, right. And those two books, I stress the importance of how eugenics really dominated science, and there were very, very few scientists that opposed eugenics. And I wonder, how in the world could so many people accept an idea which we recognize today as just ludicrous, the idea that certain groups, blacks, Jews, and Slavics, and Russians, and so on, that they're inferior to what we see that today as just irresponsible. But yet, very few scientists rejected that idea 50, 60, 70 years ago. And so we had a lot of social pressure which forced them to accept it. Now, some did reject it but didn't speak out about it. In fact, one of the main ones that spoke out about it was an American called Franz Boas. And he was Jewish himself, and he taught at Columbia University. And he ended up in trouble because he questioned the orthodox view of eugenics. And we see the same thing today among Darwinists, that they accept a worldview which I see as, how can people accept this? And as you agree as well. Well, how could they accept 50 years ago the idea that Slavics, Russians, were biologically inferior, and as one scientist said, they're human weeds and we have to eliminate them? Well, we have the same social environment which pressures back then a worldview, today another worldview, and the worldview today is, of course, Darwinism, and the worldview back then was eugenics. And I think in time, we are already beginning to recognize how wrong the worldview that scientists propagate today is, And a good example of that is I just wrote a book also on C.S. Lewis. And I point out that indeed C.S. Lewis recognized, even in his day in the 60s and 50s, how ludicrous Darwinism was, and he effectively dealt with this. Now, he wasn't a biologist, of course. He didn't talk about the fossil record, but he talked about the moral effects on society and the pressure that scientists exerted against other scientists as well as those in society to accept this idea that, indeed, from the goo to you by way of the zoo is true. And he did a really good job. In fact, I never really appreciated C.S. Lewis until I started to work on this book several years ago. And I document, indeed, that he recognized the core of the matter, and that is the harm Darwinism has done to society, and really effectively showed where it led, and he predicted it would lead to a Nazi-like totalitarianism, which, of course, is exactly what it's done.
Well, I'm going to take some of our listener questions right now. And first we're going to start with Charlie Liebert, who is from Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And Charlie Liebert is a name that many of my Iron Sharpens Iron radio listeners will recognize, because Charlie quite often is my co-host here on Iron Sharpens Iron. And Charlie happens to be founder of a ministry called SixDayCreation.com. And he has a question for you. In my discussions with non-Christians, many say that Germany was Christian at the time of Hitler. I know they were humanistic, but how do you counter that statement simply? And he says, P.S., I lost 3 great uncles with 13 children in the Holocaust. That's interesting, Charlie. I want to hear more about that, because I know that you're a Christian, so it's interesting that you lost ancestors in the Holocaust nonetheless. But if you could comment, yeah, people very often will blur the distinction between nominal mainline Christianity and the genuine Bible-believing regenerate faith.
Yeah, on my book, Hitler and the Darwinian Worldview, I cover a chapter on that, but there's been a lot written on that. It's clear that many in Germany, many so-called Christians in Germany, were not living up to what's obviously Christian. And we know Christianity teaches things like love your enemy, love your brother. How you treat others is how you basically treat Christ. And if you love your brother, then you love Christ. And, you know, there are many, many scriptures that's pretty obvious. And so pretty obvious that, indeed, they were not living up to the Christian standard. So many then, as is true today, so many were Sunday Christians. They go to church, they listen to the sermon, and they come home then, and they shed all that, and they go on living their life as if they lived before. But it's a good example, I think, of what happened. It is a good example, I don't think, I know. It's a good example of, indeed, what happens when we only have what they call veneer Christianity. And many Christians are veneer Christians. They have a covering which is Christian, but the core is not Christian. And if the core was Christian, we would have had a lot more opposition to Darwinism. But by the way, those who opposed not only Darwinism, but those who opposed the Nazi movement were primarily Christians. And the primary opposition that Germany had was primarily those who were Christians. And if there were more Christians who spoke up, it's often been documented that indeed we wouldn't have had a Holocaust, we wouldn't have had a World War II, because the Christians would have said, no, we cannot allow this, we cannot accept this to happen. But a lot of this happened under the wraps. The average person didn't know about many of these things, at least until later on in the war. And so the government really tried hard to keep it quiet until later on they got to a point where they couldn't. But indeed, that's one reason I wrote the book called Hitler and the Darwinian Nazi Worldview, was indeed I see the same thing to some degree happening today. Surveys have shown that of millennials, which is a younger generation, of millennials now 51% do not call themselves Christians, but 51% call themselves nuns, which means they're no religion. But many are atheists or agnostics. And so we see the same trends going on today. And if you follow especially what's going on at our colleges and universities, where some speaker comes to talk about his or her ideas, and they have protests and they start fires, and they, as happened at the University of California, Berkeley, you can see that in so many ways our society is moving away from Christianity, and you can see the problems it's developing. The killings, for example, in Chicago, we have more murders in Chicago than we had, I understand, in the war in Afghanistan. So one of my students was sent, he's going to be sent to Afghanistan. And I said, well, you're lucky. They could have sent you to Chicago. That'd be worse because the number of people dying in Chicago is worse than Afghanistan. And he chuckled and he says, yeah, that's true, I know. So we can see many problems today are a result of loss of our Christian roots. And that's why I did the book on the Darwin effect and how Darwinism corrodes morality, because indeed it's corroded morality, and I document that very closely in the one by Joshua Press, which, by the way, all my books are available on Amazon, and most any bookstore carries them, and Good Books carries them, and Barnes & Noble, and so they're out there.
And you can also get them through one of my sponsors. I have to throw that in there, obviously, CVBBS.com, Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, CV for Cumberland Valley, BBS for BibleBookService.com. They carry books by Jerry Bergman as well. And, well, thank you, Charlie Liebert, and we hope that you recover rapidly from surgery. That is one of the reasons Charlie is not in the studio with me today. And, of course, many of you know that my other co-host, Reverend Buzz Taylor, is normally in the studio with me, and he is returning to his full-time career after a vacation that he was on. So we hope that Buzz can return quickly as our co-host as well. Charlie, you are getting a free copy of this book that we are discussing, How Darwinianism or Darwinism Corrodes Morality, and that is compliments of Joshua Press and also compliments of our friends at Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, CVBBS.com, who I just mentioned, who will be shipping that out to you at no charge to you or to us. So thank you very much for contributing to today's program. By the way, I keep screwing up the pronunciation. Are both acceptable pronunciations? Is it Darwinism and Darwinianism? Are they both acceptable, or am I just an idiot?
Yeah, no, Darwinism is the common term, but Darwinianism, I guess that would be... actually, I never thought about that much, but you see them both, so I guess it doesn't really matter.
Well, you've already touched on this, but we'll read Daniel's question from Bakersfield, California. Daniel from Bakersfield, California says, my question for Dr. Jerry Bergman is, would you say that the popularity of Darwinian evolution has led to the low view of human life we have in our culture today? In my opinion, there seems to be a correlation between the full acceptance of Darwinian evolution and abortion and assisted suicide.
Yeah, certainly with abortion there is. In fact, I have a chapter on that in the book on how Darwinism corrodes morality, and I show indeed that the arguments they used when the abortion case was before the Supreme Court, 30 years ago now, close to that, when they argued it, there was a professor from the University of Michigan, the head of the genetics department, and he basically argued when abortions are normally performed, you're not removing or killing a human, you're killing a fish, because at that stage, according to Haeckel's idea of Darwinism, you basically... not human, you're a fish, and they call that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And he used the example that they used to claim that indeed at that stage we have gill slits. Well, we don't have gill slits, we don't have gills at that stage. Unfortunately, my biology textbook we use correctly calls them pharyngeal slits, pharyngeal cliffs. And they're folds in the chin area, and these are part of the pharyngeal area, and they're not gill slits, they're not gills, they have nothing to do with gills. And so that idea was totally wrong, and that was popular in the textbooks for many years, and now, of course, we've shown that the drawings that Haeckel used to support his ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny theory were forgeries, they're wrong. The actual stages, if you get photographs of them, are very different than what Haeckel showed. And so he used dishonest pictures to try to convince his idea of ontogeny. Ontogeny basically... what that means is that when we are really, really young in the womb, we basically are like amoebas, and then we evolve into fish. Then we evolve into amphibians, and we evolve into reptiles, and we evolve into mammals, and then primates, and then humans. So we go through our evolutionary steps in the womb. And that sounds, of course, ridiculous today, but indeed that was believed for many, many years. In fact, that was taught in biology books for many, many years, and took a secular scientist to examine, indeed, the animals that Haeckel used in his drawings to find out, to prove, indeed, that he was totally wrong and that they're forgeries and that we do not go through these various evolutionary stages. We are a human from day one. When we become a zygote, we are a human, period. And there's no question about that. If you allow the zygote to develop, you're going to end up with a child and adult human. So we're not fish. We never were fish. We never went through that fish stage, and the idea that they had for over 100 years is simply wrong. And so that's a very good example, because indeed I think today, if the case were to go before the Supreme Court, I do not think that they would rule the way they did 40 years ago, that they would recognize indeed that at month 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, we are human, fully human, we're not fish, we're not any stage of evolution, and therefore a major argument they used quite a few years ago is just simply wrong. It's simply not true.
Well, I guess now we know the basis for the classic Don Knotts movie, The Incredible Mr. Limpet, when he became a fish, if you recall. I don't know if you ever saw that that movie in the 60s, Dr. Bergman, but that was a childhood classic of a scientist who became a fish. But anyway, I digress. thank you, Daniel, in Bakersfield, California. You also have won a free copy of the book we are discussing, How Darwinianism Corrodes Morality, by the dear Jerry Bridges, our late brother in Christ, who's now in glory. I have interviewed him while he was still with us, and your name just looked a lot like his. Jerry Bergman, that is compliments of Joshua Press, and also compliments of Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, who will be shipping that out to you. Please make sure that we have your full mailing address if you could email that to us so we can get that out to you as soon as possible. Our email address again is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And we also have a listener all the way in Slovenia, Joe, who says, please ask Dr. Bergman to explain to us how the Darwinian evolutionist gets around or explains the absence of transitional species in the fossil record. It seems to me, as others have pointed out, that if Darwinian evolution were true, we would expect to see lots of transitional species in the fossil record, but if I understand correctly, they are absent. What does the fact of their absence tell us about the willingness of the unregenerate to believe and propagate social policies based on a theory that is devoid of the key piece of evidence that would substantiate its claims? Thank you for your invaluable work. And also the key piece of evidence that would demonstrate that it's science at all. But anyway, Dr. Bergman, if you could respond to Joe from Slovenia.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and Darwin himself asked that, and he said, why are there not innumerable numbers of transitional fossils? And he said there weren't. He recognized there weren't. And the response today from scientists is, well, we just got to keep digging. We just got to keep looking. And we'll find them. They're out there, but we have to keep looking. But some recognize that we've been looking for 150 years and we haven't found what they're expecting at all. We have found some which appear to be transitional, but if we look at them more carefully, we find out that they're not. But they recognize that's a huge problem. And so their response is that one of the latest responses is that what happened is during the transition from one animal type to another, it occurred so fast it didn't leave any record of fossil in the fossil record. So therefore, it's not there because evolution occurred so fast in between the stages. So when we were one animal, left lots of fossils, and when we evolved into another kind of animal, it didn't leave very many because we evolved so rapidly, is the theory. And that, of course, is a explanation which tries to explain lack of information. And, you know, you can come up with all kinds of reasons for lack of information, but and they believe it so strongly that they have to come up with some explanation, and that's the one that they came up with. Primarily Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge came up with that explanation. And it's widely accepted, but it's not universally accepted because many scientists recognize that what you need is clear evidence of transitional forms, and it's just not there. And I have actually a book coming out on that, should be out any week, on the problem of transitional forms, and I show, indeed, that all the transitional forms just are not there, and what they're expecting is links between fish and other animals, for example, or between dinosaurs and other animals. And what they find is the first dinosaur was a dinosaur, the first amphibian was an amphibian, the first, you know, blue jay was a blue jay, and so on. And so they're finding they're simply not there, and they have a problem, and they realize this. And that's why some propose that we evolved from another planet, and then we came to the Earth as, you know, in some on some spaceship or some rocket ship, which is called the Superman hypothesis, by the way, or we came to the Earth as a result of being carried on a meteor or a comet. And those are the options that Neil deGrasse Tyson talks about, but they're clearly ad hoc, and they're clearly trying to explain lack of evidence, and they are clearly problematic, and very hard to give up a theory you believed all your life, and the world around you believes, the science believes. So, you know, they're trying to maintain their belief. Same thing when eugenics, they tried to maintain their belief, even though the evidence just wasn't there. They, for example, got a bunch of skeletons from Jews, and they took the flesh off, and they wanted to display these in a museum in Berlin, and they were trying to find evidence that these Jews were inferior, that this, what they called a race then, was inferior. And they couldn't find any. They just couldn't find any evidence that indeed these people were inferior. So they rationalized it away. Well, we got the wrong set. We need to get another 100 somewhere else so we can indeed deflesh these and we can indeed show that they're inferior. So you don't find evidence. They just keep looking for evidence in other places. And that's what they did then. And now, of course, we recognize how appallingly foolish that is. But back then, they believed it so strongly that they just couldn't see reality. It's said that to see reality, you've got to take off your evolution glasses and look at the world the way it is. And when they look at the world through their evolution glasses, they can't see the world the way it is, and no wonder they just can't see the evidence right in front of them, which, of course, we're talking about now.
I don't want to sound overly sensationalistic here, but when Joe asks about, you know, the willingness of the unregenerate to propagate social policies based on theories devoid of any evidence, you wonder how much of this is due to demonic influence. Now, I am a non-charismatic, thoroughgoing five-point Calvinist. I am not one who is prone to sensationalism, because I know that the liberals like to laugh at things like that. But do you think that that is really a very obvious element of this whole thing, because it seems that it has reached a level of insanity that the scientific world has bought things as gospel that you cannot detract from, or you will lose your reputation and livelihood.
That's true. That's a very good point, and you certainly wonder if that's the case. But by and large, I think the case is that it's just surrounded by this worldview, and they accept it because that's what's in their environment.
And you think it's also, like, one of the things I just said is that they may lose their jobs if they start to question these things.
Yeah, that's a big factor in many people. And when you get to know people on a personal level, you find that many scientists have major doubts about Darwinism, but they're not going to voice these publicly because they know it could cause them problems. And so, you know, as they say, when you're drinking coffee after work and talking about these things, you realize that a lot of people have big problems. Scientists have big problems with this worldview, and but they say, you know, I'm not going to talk about this to other people because I know they're not going to be receptive, and it may jeopardize my career, and so I'll just, you know, stay in the closet, and that's what we call it, stay in the closet until later on the closet becomes more open and more accepting. But for now, a lot just prefer to stay in the closet.
Well, it's one thing that's fascinating to me is that you would think scientists would be absolutely titillated and excited when they hear about tissue being found on fossils and so on, you know, in relation to dinosaurs and so on. Why is it that they are rejecting these things or not really treating them with the enthusiasm that they deserve?
Well, they realize they have a big problem with this. Of course, finding what they claim is 65-year-old, million-year-old fossils, dinosaur fossils, and you break them open and you dissolve the bone away with acids, and then you find they have soft tissue, what looks like blood cells. And and the DNA and so on. You wonder how in the world that these 65-million-year-old body parts could be preserved for that many years. Well, they're trying to come up with reasons, and I think it's the same thing we end up with in the other areas we talked about, that they're looking for reasons, but they can't find any. So eventually you think they're going to have to say, well, maybe these bones are not 65 million years old. They found certain ones in Madagascar, but now they found them in the United States, and there's been dozens of studies which replicated the original findings. Indeed, they found that dinosaurs, even in North Dakota, dinosaurs indeed can yield soft tissue, blood vessels, and blood cells, and so on. And it takes a while before they realize the implications of what they found, and they're now trying to come up with reasons for what they found, but I don't think they're going to be able to, and they're going to have to admit that, you know, this appears that these dinosaurs are not as old as they think they are.
Wasn't some female paleontologist, like, ridiculed or in some way having her career jeopardized, who actually was one of the discoverers of the tissue?
Yeah, Mary Schweitzer was one of the discoverers, and probably, what, 10, 12 years ago now she made this discovery, and there was criticism, a lot of criticism, but when they replicated her studies, and they have many times, as I mentioned, when they replicate her studies, they found the same thing, and so she's accurate. What she's saying is indeed valid, and as we have now, I'm not sure how many, but 50, 100 or so studies that found the same thing, I mean, you can't deny it. If she says, you do this and dissolve the bone away with chemicals, you find this, and I do it, and I find it, and you do it, and you find it, and somebody else does it, and they find the same thing, you can't deny it anymore. You have to recognize, indeed, that that's fact. And therefore, they're still grappling with it, but eventually I think they're going to have to get to the point that, indeed, they recognize their theory has got a big problem, and they have to deal with it in some way. Although right now they're just shoving it under the rug, and they're saying, well, we'll figure it out. It's a problem, but we'll work on it, and we'll figure out what's going on. But they're not so far, and I don't think they will, although we'll wait and see. But it doesn't look promising for their side. It looks very promising for our side.
Yeah, amazing that they would be shoving that or sweeping that under the rug. Absolutely amazing. That you would think that they would be totally amazed and fascinated and excited. Oh, this is really ridiculous. But we're going to be going to a break right now. By the way, thank you, Joe, in Slovenia, and thank you for providing us with an American address where Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service can ship you your free copy of How Darwinism Corrodes Morality by Jerry Bergman. And thank you very much for contributing to today's program. That will be in the mail to you shortly, so keep your eye open for a package from cvbbs.com, CV for Cumberland Valley, BBS for BibleBookService.com. And once again, we thank Joshua Press for providing these books for us today to give away to you, the listeners. And we're going to a break right now. If you'd like to join us on the air as well, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com. chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Please give us your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside of the USA. Don't go away. We will be right back after these messages with more of Dr. Jerry Bergman and How Darwinism Corrodes Morality.
Tired of box store Christianity, of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience, featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times. 631-929-3512. Or check out their website at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation. The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions, like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new topical reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Whichever edition you choose, trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnson, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, here to tell you about an exciting offer from World Magazine, my trusted source for news from a Christian perspective. Try World at no charge for 90 days and get a free copy of R.C. Sproul's book, Relationship Between Church and State. I rely on World because I trust the reporting. I gain insight from the analysis, and World provides clarity to the news stories that really matter. I believe you'll also find World to be an invaluable resource to better understand critical topics with a depth that's simply not found in other media outlets. Armed with this coverage, World can help you to be a voice of wisdom in your family and your community. This trial includes bi-weekly issues of World Magazine, on-scene reporting from World Radio, and the fully shareable content of World Digital. Simply visit wmg.org/ironsharpens to get your World trial and Dr. Sproul's book all free. No obligation with no credit card required. Visit World News Group at wmg.org/ironsharpens today.
Have you been blessed by Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? We remain on the air because of our faithful sponsors and because of listeners like you. There are four ways you can help. First, do you know potential sponsors who may wish to advertise their goods or services on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? Second, whenever possible, purchase the products or use the services that our sponsors advertise. And then let them know that you heard about them on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Thirdly, you can also donate to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio by going to our website at ironsharpensironradio.com and click support at the top of the page. But most importantly, keep Iron Sharpens Iron Radio in your prayers. We hope that Iron Sharpens Iron Radio blesses you for many years to come.
Thrivin Financial is not your typical financial services provider. As a membership organization, we help Christians be wise with money and live generously every day. And for the fourth year in a row, we were named one of the world's most ethical companies by the Ethisphere Institute, a leading international think tank dedicated to the creation, advancement, and sharing of best practices in business ethics. Contact me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433 to learn more about the Thrivin Difference.
We know we were made for so much more than ordinary life.
Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivin story.
We were made to thrive.
One sure way all Iron Sharpens Iron Radio listeners can help keep my show on the air is to support my advertisers. I know you all use batteries every day, so I'm urging you all from now on to exclusively use BatteryDepot.com for all your battery needs. At BatteryDepot.com, they're changing the status quo. They're flipping the script. They're sticking it to the man. In other words, they'd like to change the battery industry for good by providing an extensive inventory of top-of-the-line batteries that are uniformly new, dependable, and affordable. Ordering from BatteryDepot.com ensures you'll always get fresh out-of-the-box batteries you can count on to work properly at competitive prices. Whether you need batteries for cordless phones, cell phones, radios, PCs, laptops, tablets, baby monitors, hearing aids, smoke detectors, credit card readers, digital cameras, electronic cigarettes, GPSs, MP3 players, watches, or nearly anything else you own that needs batteries, go to BatteryDepot.com. Next day shipping available.
All products protected by 30-day guarantees and 6-month warranties. Call 866-403-3768. That's 866-403-3768. Or go to BatteryDepot.com. That's BatteryDepot.com.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ
in fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bob Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402. Or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
Every day at thousands of community centers, high schools, middle schools, juvenile institutions, coffee shops, and local hangouts, Long Island Youth for Christ staff and volunteers meet with young people who need Jesus. We are rural and urban, and we are always about the message of Jesus. Our mission is to have a noticeable spiritual impact on Long Island, New York, by engaging young people in the lifelong journey of following Christ. Long Island Youth for Christ has been a stalwart bedrock ministry since 1959. We have a world-class staff and a proven track record of bringing consistent love and encouragement to youths in need all over the country and around the world. Help honor our history by becoming a part of our future. Volunteer, donate, pray, or all of the above. For details, call Long Island Youth for Christ at 631-385-8333. That's 631-385-8333. Or visit liyfc.org. That's liyfc.org.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for A Visit to the Pastor's Study, because everyone needs a pastor.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnes, and if you just tuned us in, our guest today for the full 2 hours, with about an hour to go, is Dr. Jerry Bergman. He has 9 degrees, including 7 graduate degrees, has studied for his past college work in biology, chemistry, psychology, and evaluation and research. He's a prolific writer, a teacher of biology, chemistry, and biochemistry at Northwest State in Archbold, Ohio, and we are discussing his book, How Darwinism Corrodes Morality. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question, our email address is chrisarnsen@gmail.com. chrisarnsen@gmail.com, and there are a number of you still waiting to have your questions asked and answered, so we will get to you as soon as we can. Before I return to our discussion, I want to remind you of a couple of things. First of all, the Philadelphia Conference on Reformed Theology is going to be held April 28th through the 30th at Proclamation Presbyterian Church in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. I will be there, God willing, with an exhibitor's booth, and this is an event that is being orchestrated by the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. The speakers at this conference include Dan Doriani, Richard Phillips, Carl Truman, and others, and the theme is Reformation, Recovering the Essence of the Gospel. Once again, that's April 28th through the 30th at Proclamation Presbyterian Church in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, a suburb of Philadelphia. For more details, go to alliancenet.org, alliancenet.org. Please let them know that Iron Sharpens Iron Radio told you about the conference. Also, we have coming up in the not-so-distant future the Banner of Truth Conference, And many of you recognize the name Banner of Truth. They are a stalwart in regard to theologically sound literature that they have been publishing for decades, much of which are gems that they have brought back from the past. But they also have some contemporary authors that they have published, all theologically sound. One of those publishers where there's no guessing game on whether they are going to be aberrant or not. These authors they publish are all really biblically solid and trustworthy. And if you'd like to go to their U.S. Ministers Conference, if you are a pastor or church leader, go to banneroftruth.org, banneroftruth.org. The conference is being held from May 30th, which is a Tuesday, through Thursday, June 1st, in Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania, at Elizabethtown College. And they have a whole host of phenomenal speakers at this event, speakers many of whom have been interviewed on Iron Sharpens Iron, some of them many times, including Joel Beakey, Jeff Thomas, William Vanderward, Mark Johnson, Jonathan Master, Carlton Wynn, Ian Hamilton. The theme is the Living and Enduring Word. Once again, that's the 2017 U.S. Ministers Conference being held by the Banner of Truth. Go to banneroftruth.org and click on events. banneroftruth.org. And, of course, there are also events in the U.K. So if you live in the United Kingdom, click on one of those conferences. But the one I'm specifically addressing, you must click on the U.S. Ministers Conference to get those details. And I also want to remind you that Iron Sharpens Iron Radio is in urgent need of benefactors and new advertisers and sponsors. I just really urge you to consider prayerfully either donating to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, if you do indeed love this program, if it benefits your life, if it's edifying to you, if it's a blessing to you, then please, if you are financially capable, we never want you taking out of the collection plate of your own church or denying your own family if you are struggling to provide for your own home. But if the Lord has blessed you above and beyond your ability to provide for your church and your home, we would ask of you to please donate to us if possible. And those of you who have listened to this program since 2006 know that I have gone years without making any public appeal for donation. It just so happens that we are in very desperate times financially, and my current advertisers have been urging me to make these public appeals, and that is one of the key reasons I am doing so. If you would like to advertise with us, email me at chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com. If you have a church that you pastor, or perhaps you are a leader in a parachurch organization, or you have a business, corporation, or you're having a special event, please email me at chrisarnson@gmail.com and put advertising in the subject line. For donating, just go to ironsharpensironradio.com, ironsharpensironradio.com, click on support at the top of the page, and that will give you an address where you can make, where you can mail your checks made payable to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. And I thank you for your patience in putting up with me as I discuss, or as I make these public appeals for donations. All right, we are back now with our interview with Dr. Jerry Bergman on how Darwinianism or Darwinism corrodes morality. And we have Jerry in Charlestown, New Hampshire, who has a question. He says, when I have talked to friends who embrace Darwinism regarding their foundations for morality, their inevitable appeal is to moral relativism. What I have tried to gently show to these friends is that no one functionally lives that way. For instance, if one's child is being murdered before their eyes, no one would say, I find this personally morally objectionable. No, they would claim it would be absolutely wrong, no matter the culture, no matter how many other people believe it to be right. Doesn't this moral outrage reveal that we are indeed made in the image of God and that God's law is written on our hearts, as Paul says in Romans 2? Dr. Bergman?
Good question, and that's why a lot of people reject Darwinism and the worldview, the Darwinian worldview, And also they accept Christianity because they recognize that indeed we seem to have a innate sense of what's moral and what's right and what's wrong. And this innate sense, now, of course, part of it's the environment, no doubt. Part of it's our culture, our parents, and so on. But virtually every culture we know has this sense, and therefore the values among virtually every culture in the world they've studied are pretty close, pretty similar. In fact, you have to work hard, very hard, to overcome this dislike of doing things like killing children. It's difficult. Even in Nazi Germany, the leaders said that, you know, this is something we can be proud of, that we overcame this tremendous resistance against doing what we're doing, but yet we're doing what we're doing in the end for the good of the German people, that we're eliminating inferior people. And they likened it to a surgeon. A surgeon goes into a body, removes a defective organ, a cancer, for example, and does that in the end of helping the patient. Well, of course, we recognize that, but they saw the same thing. We're eliminating these inferior races, these human weeds. We have to do that to preserve the purity of the German race. And it's difficult, but we've done it, and we've killed millions of people, and we ought to be proud of what we've done. That's what Heinrich Himmler and a few others have said. Of course, today we recognize the problem of that, but they recognize that that was very difficult to overcome, the innate moral sense that people had. And that's ironically why they developed the gas chambers. They used to basically, when they went into a country, when they invaded Ukraine, for example, or Russia, they would go into the country and they would have these killing squads that would kill people such as Jews and Slavics and people they thought were inferior. And this bothered a lot of the German soldiers. And the government recognized that this is a problem to go into these countries and cold blood murder children, women, and so on, innocent people. And so this is why they decided to develop the camp system, where the individuals were murdered inside the camp in the gas chambers. And that was a solution. In fact, that was determined in a suburb of Berlin about 1944, I believe. The Council of Wannsee, it's called. It was a mansion that used to be owned by a Jewish family, I was told. And they met there to decide, what are we going to do with this problem that we have? So many Germans are very upset with what we're doing. And so they said, well, let's remove it from the field, let's bring these people to the camps, and then let's systematically murder them inside the camps. And that was the, quote, the final solution. That's what they finally decided to do. And so it's very clear that, as you think of your own life, when you were very, very young, you knew certain things were wrong. Nobody told you they were wrong, but you knew they were wrong from this moral sense that we have. And that's one thing that impressed C.S. Lewis. Why would we have this moral sense? How could evolution explain this? Well, they couldn't. And so C.S. Lewis recognized that, indeed, the moral sense must be God-given, and therefore that's why we have it, and that's why it's universal, and that's why it takes a lot of effort, a lot of training, a lot of experience to overcome this, and why many people, I've talked to people who were involved in the military, for example, and they say, you know, even after 30 years of being involved in the military, you still are revolts you to kill the enemy, even though you know it's the enemy and you have to. But on the other hand, many people never really overcome this innate sense that they have that this is wrong. And you have many people who come back from war, and then they end up suffering from the experience of that, and you have many people who suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome, and a lot of it is as a result of basically killing people, which they never really overcome, and which may affect them for the rest of their lives. So we have many innate moral values which God put into us because he knew that we would violate them freely if indeed we could. And of course, people have to work hard, and some people it's easier than others to overcome this moral sense, but indeed they realize they have to work hard to overcome this moral sense, as Heinrich Himmler recognized.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for contributing to today's show with your excellent question. You have also won a free copy of the book by the other Jerry Bergman, How Darwinism Corrodes Morality. And please make sure that we have your full mailing address so that Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service can ship that out to you free of charge at cvbbs.com. So keep your eye out for a package with a return address on the envelope or the package that says cvbbs.com for Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service. CVBBS.com. And Let's see here. We have Scott, who says that he lives about 20 miles from Northwest State College. And he says, that's in Bryan, Ohio. And he says, please ask your guest how he personally feels about the school of thought that suggests a separation of biblical interpretation from the book of nature.
That's a good thought. And, of course, as I teach in a secular college, I have to be very careful that I present information which is appropriate in that venue. And, of course, I don't talk about the Christian things with people. That's unfortunate. In this country, we can't. And, of course, I try to scrupulously obey the requirements there. And it'd be nice if we could, but on the other hand, that's not what the law says. And one way of dealing with that is to change the law. And I notice when I go to Canada to speak that they know they do not have this requirement. And one chemistry professor I was with when I was in a major Canadian university, he said, I open all my classes in chemistry with the Bible scripture. And I say, isn't that a problem? Isn't that going to cause a problem? He says, well, no, there's no problem here. The students like it as a whole. Even the students that aren't supportive of the Christian message like it, by and large. So it's not a problem there, but it is a problem here. And so what we have to do is change the law so that indeed the law allows us to be more open about what we believe. But on the other hand, you have to be very sensitive to students and what they feel and be very careful about presenting things that will upset them. You need to help the students grow in the field you're teaching. And if you say things that are upsetting, of course, that can impede your trying to help students grow into a particular science or a particular discipline. And so I'm very careful, and I don't mention that at all. I did have one person a long time ago asked me if I attended church. And I kind of hemmed and hawed, and I think I turned red, and I said yes, but I've never had that happen again. And so I think about it. Maybe I shouldn't have said, well, that's really not an appropriate question. But that really illustrates the problem we have if you're an active Christian in the academic environment today. And so I'm, again, very careful of not bridging that chasm. And again, that's too bad. We have that. But on the other hand, it takes some court decisions to be able to change that. On the other hand, you don't want to go to a biology class and get someone to lecture about things that are not related to biology. You don't want to go to a math class and have someone talk about, you know, the election, which I know happens, but you want to go to a math class to learn about math, not to learn about whether Trump should or should not be president. And so you have to be careful about talking about political things and other things, and so I'm very careful that in classroom I appear neutral, and I help the students grow in understanding, but you have to be very careful that you don't indoctrinate students in either side. I mean, I don't like people indoctrinating students in atheism, and I can see that there's concerns about me attempting to indoctrinate students in my worldview, so we need to help them understand, pose questions, help them think about issues, but clearly we should not indoctrinate. That's not the function of colleges, and the professor I mentioned who teaches chemistry, he also does not indoctrinate, although there the line is a lot fuzzier in Canada, but on the other hand, he feels it's not really helpful to, as they say, bash him over the head with the Bible. That doesn't help them understand the message. Now, if you teach philosophy or you teach world religions, then, of course, that's a different area where your subject matter is indeed related to this area, and students expect you to talk about this in those classes, and therefore, it's less of a problem. But I don't teach primarily in that area, so I teach the sciences, so I have to stick very close to, indeed, the information which we know from scientific investigation.
Yes, that's completely acceptable and understandable and right if you're being if you're hired by a secular institution or an institution that does not have an open religious bias, then obviously you would be stealing from your employer if you were to start to teach theology during those courses that you were hired to teach, if you were teaching another subject and so on. So that's completely, obviously the only time that is ever sin is when you are denying the faith or when you are lying to your students, teaching them things that you know to be untrue and so on.
Yeah, and I try to give them ideas and say, well, you know, this is one idea, and what's your thoughts? I try to draw students in. I'm not one that I like to stand up there and lecture for 2 hours. I prefer to have discussions, debates, et cetera, with students. And so I deliberately say things which might be a little bit controversial, and I say, okay, that's one idea. What do you think? What's your thoughts? What's your opinion? And so I try to draw students in effectively, and so far I'm not aware of any concerns that have been raised in this area, and I encourage students to, you know, if I say something that's inappropriate, let me know so I can be aware. I show films that every now and then, short films, I try to, 12 minutes, because, you know, students, after a while, it defeats the purpose, but short films, clips I show, and I ask them, if there's any problems with this, let me know. And typically, if there's one person that objects to the film, I don't show it again. I have enough material that if one person objects, I don't need to show it again. I just prefer to show films, and that indeed I have unanimous or very, very close to unanimous agreement that indeed the film is worthwhile and useful. So there's enough material out there that I can pretty effectively stay away from material that may cause even a slight problem. I don't want to upset any student, and I want to be very sensitive to their needs, and I consciously try to be aware of where they're coming from and indeed what their worldview is. But I do raise questions which they hopefully think about, which will help them think about some of these issues.
In fact, your employers are to be commended because in this world where, as we were already saying, people who are in any way against the status quo of science, what is acceptable in the secular scientific community, they very often have their careers destroyed and their reputations maligned, and it's quite a commendable thing that they've hired someone knowing that you are not according to their ilk. But just that actually reminds me of another question. Is Darwinism basically on a steady level of acceptance in the scientific world, or is there any noticeable decline within the ranks of secular science in regard to the acceptance of this theory that seems to have zero evidence for much of what, if not most of what, it promotes?
Well, there is more and more, and I'm becoming aware of more and more people who really are raising major questions about the idea, and I think it's only a matter of time before indeed it's overthrown. It may not be in my lifetime or may not be soon, but on the other hand, more and more people are becoming aware of their problems, and there's conventions and conferences and books written by evolutionists who basically bring out their concerns that they have with the theory, and so these concerns are being talked about. In fact, we're having conventions in various cities which indeed talk about the problems of Darwinism, so they are aware of it, but this doesn't mean they're going to give up that worldview, and it is a worldview we're talking about. It's the way they see the world, and they're aware of the problems, but they still accept the worldview, and to overcome a worldview takes quite a bit, and so many are still supportive, but they recognize there are certainly problems in the idea. Like I mentioned, Neil deGrasse Tyson, he spends not his time talking about abiogenesis on the Earth, the origin of life on the Earth, but talking about abiogenesis somewhere else, on the stars, some star or some planet far away. And so you can see why he'd spend so much time. He's concerned that indeed we have a problem with origin of spontaneous generation of life on the Earth, and therefore he moves it somewhere else. But as I said earlier, that doesn't solve the problem.
By the way, Scott in Bryan, Ohio, you have won the final copy that we have available of How Darwinism Corrodes Morality. So please make sure that we have your full mailing address so that Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service can ship that out to you. And so keep your eye open for a package from cvbbs.com, CV for Cumberland Valley, BBS for BibleBookService.com. And we also want to make sure we thank Joshua Press again for providing us with these books. And their website, by the way, is joshuapress.com. joshuapress.com if you want to see anything else that they have available in print. So we hope to be working with Joshua Press for a long time to come and promote other authors that they have. I know that my friend Dr. Michael Haken, who I have had on this program a number of times, is one of the authors they publish, and that is a very positive sign for me. I forgot to ask you earlier. I'm assuming you are a young Earth creationist, as I am, just because of the fact that I saw your bio on the Creation Ministries website from Australia. But
yeah, I have a big problem with the old age view, but I look at the main evidence for me, for the young earth view, at least with humans, is that no way that humans could be more than 6,000 years old, because mutations are accumulating, we know that, and when you look at the data, you can see indeed that we're getting more and more mutations, and there's no way that mutational degeneration would not occur if we were 100,000 years old, because we would be extinct if indeed we were that old. So the evidence for humans and all life, by the way, is clearly that indeed life simply could not be that old. And so since I'm not a geophysicist, I'm a biologist, I look at the evidence from biology, and that convinces me indeed that life could not be that old.
And in fact, you may have stolen the thunder of one of our listeners, Pastor Sterling Vanderwerker of Shepherd's Fellowship in Greensboro, North Carolina, writes, "What other empirical evidence in genetics point toward a limit to the length of time for human life, considering your prior comment on the approximately 100 mutations per generation? Thanks for the great show, brothers." Is there anything else you care to add to what Pastor Sterling has said?
Oh, you could add a lot, and I'll just give you one brief example. We have what they call a repair system. Now, evolution works by accumulation of mutations. So evolution needs lots of mutations. Of course, we know they have a lot, but they're almost always near neutral or deleterious. But we have a repair system. When mutations occur, even favorable ones, they're repaired like 99.99% of the time they're repaired. So how could evolution explain the fact that there is a complex system? In fact, there's 12 that we know of complex systems which repair mistakes. So if evolution is a result of mistakes, how would you explain the fact that we have a repair system that repairs those mistakes? So let's say there's a mutation that occurs which is beneficial. Well, the chances are very, very high that that's going to be repaired. Well, that would work against evolution, against the theory. And, of course, how could you explain the repair system which cannot function until all the parts are there, because it's a complex system? And when you cover this in class, the students get lost, and I explain, well, you know, you have to kind of realize I'm trying to simplify it and make it as basic as I can. But on the other hand, they recognize that indeed it's very complex, and they wonder how in the world this could come about, because this opposes Darwinism. And of course, I let them think about it. I don't give them any answers. I don't tell them what I feel, but I help them understand the repair system, and it's complex indeed, and it's not going to work until you have every single part. That's an idea called irreducible complexity, which says basically that systems require more than one part to work, which many systems do. They will not work by definition if they lose that one part. Now, that doesn't mean that a system can't lose a part. It means there's an irreducible core, and for them to function, they have to have a certain minimum number of parts. And we know with the body, they have to have clearly a certain minimum number of parts. And we know, for example, if a mutation damages one of these parts, then it either is lethal to the organism, or that part does not develop, that whole system does not develop. And that could mean, for example, we have a repair system that is triggered by a protein called P53. And if P53 is damaged, the repair system doesn't work. And as a result, people are far more prone to develop cancer. So that illustrates that this part is necessary for this part of the repair system to work. And the idea of irreducible complexity is, you know, it's obvious that certain things, you have to have so many parts, a watch, a mousetrap, no matter what we're talking about, you have to have so many parts before it works. There's a certain minimum number of parts. For humans to work, of course, you have to have a heart, you have to have kidneys, you have to have lungs and so on, and you can't live without those. And you can live without certain things like fingers and so on, but there are certain parts, the irreducible core, you cannot live without. And that's true with the repair system as well.
Well, thank you, Pastor Sterling. Sorry we don't have any books to give to you today. But I hope that Dr. Jerry Bergman returns to our program often, since he's quite a prolific writer. And perhaps the next time we have him on, God willing, and if Dr. Bergman is willing as well, perhaps you can win a book next time written by him. But we want to also thank you, Pastor Sterling Vanderwerker of Shepherd Fellowship in Greensboro, North Carolina, for the recent donation that we got in the mail from you. And thank you so much. It means more to me than I can convey to you in the English language. And please keep praying for Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, that we may have many more years of life before us, so that we could continue to bless folks like you with the guests that we interview daily on this show. We're going to go to our final break right now, and if you would like to join us on the air with a question, now is your time to do so, because we are running out of time. Only got less than a half hour left now. So our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Dr. Jerry Bergman and how Darwinism corrodes morality.
One sure way all Iron Sharpens Iron Radio listeners can help keep my show on the air is to support my advertisers. I know you all use batteries every day, so I'm urging you all from now on to exclusively use BatteryDepot.com for all your battery needs. At BatteryDepot.com, they're changing the status quo. They're flipping the script. They're sticking it to the man. In other words, they'd like to change the battery industry for good by providing an extensive inventory of top-of-the-line batteries that are uniformly new, dependable, and affordable. Ordering from BatteryDepot.com ensures you'll always get fresh out-of-the-box batteries you can count on to work properly at competitive prices. Whether you need batteries for cordless phones, cell phones, radios, PCs, laptops, tablets, baby monitors, hearing aids, smoke detectors, credit card readers, digital cameras, electronic cigarettes, GPSs, MP3 players, watches, or nearly anything else you own that needs batteries, go to BatteryDepot.com. Next day shipping available. All products protected by 30-day guarantees and 6-month warranties. Call 866-403-3768. That's 866-403-3768. Or go to BatteryDepot.com. That's BatteryDepot.com.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750. That's 508-528-5750. Or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at ProvidenceBaptistChurchMA.org. That's ProvidenceBaptistChurchMA.org. Or even on SermonAudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Have you been blessed by Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? We remain on the air because of our faithful sponsors and because of listeners like you. There are four ways you can help. First, do you know potential sponsors who may wish to advertise their goods or services on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? Second, whenever possible, purchase the products or use the services that our sponsors advertise. And then let them know that you heard about them on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Thirdly, you can also donate to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio by going to our website at ironsharpensironradio.com and click support at the top of the page. But most importantly, keep Iron Sharpens Iron Radio in your prayers. We hope that Iron Sharpens Iron Radio blesses you for many years to come.
Iron Sharpens Iron welcomes Solid Rock Remodeling to our family of sponsors.
serving South Central Pennsylvania, Solid Rock Remodeling is focused on discovering, understanding, and exceeding your expectations. They deliver personalized project solutions with exceptional results. Solid Rock Remodeling offers a full range of home renovations, including kitchen and bath remodeling, decks, porches, windows and doors, roof and siding, and more. For a clear, detailed professional estimate, call this trustworthy team of problem solvers who provide superior results that stand the test of time. Call Solid Rock Remodeling at 717-697-1981, 717-697-1981, or visit solidrockremodeling.com. That's solidrockremodeling.com. Solid Rock Remodeling, bringing new life to your home.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnes, and if you just tuned us in, our guest today for the previous 90 minutes and the next half hour to come has been and will continue to be Dr. Jerry Bergman. And we are discussing his book, How Darwinism Corrodes Morality. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question, our email address is chrisarnsen@gmail.com. chrisarnsen@gmail.com. CJ in Lindenhurst, Long Island, New York, asks, how have some figures that our audience may or may not recognize that had prominent roles in society and shaping our history been negatively affected by Darwinism, And one name that you rarely hear in discussion is Havelock Ellis. Are you familiar with this figure, and what can you tell us about Havelock Ellis?
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar with Havelock Ellis, yeah. He became a Darwinist and eugenicist, and he was one of the main persons behind the so-called free love movement. He felt that we can have more than one car, we can have more than one house, we can have more than one pet. Why can't we have more than one person we love, we have sex with? So he really pushed that, and he practiced that himself much of his life. In fact, him and Margaret Sanger, who was the founder of the birth control movement in this country and founder of Planned Parenthood, today it's called Planned Parenthood, they were lovers among others. And so he was quite infamous, very well-known writer. And his books that he wrote a number of books about sex. The books that he wrote became very popular and very prominent, and he was a major figure in the conversion of the one man, one woman, one relationship, and no promiscuity and no adultery, etc. He was very influential in breaking down those barriers, which we can see a common problem in our society around us. So him and many others. In fact, almost every major literary figure in the past century or so was influenced by Darwinism. I can't name one that wasn't.
So you're saying this individual is actually a lover of Margaret Sanger?
Well, he had a relationship with Margaret Sanger.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Sanger was the one who, of course, started basically the birth control movement, and she was really, she was eugenicist as well. And she also talked about we need to reduce the number of inferior races. And therefore, she had her birth control clinics were founded primarily in poor neighborhoods, primarily black neighborhoods. In fact, today they're still found primarily in black neighborhoods. And she was very concerned about reducing the black population because she felt that blacks were inferior, and therefore the number should be reduced. And she felt one of the most humane ways of doing this was to basically encourage black women to practice birth control. In fact, she recruited black pastors to be able to do this. And she wrote quite a bit about the eugenics movement and her support of it. And she's pretty open in what she wanted to do, although today it's not talked about a lot because, of course, Planned Parenthood not exactly as proud of her past. But it's interesting that many well-known people saw Margaret Sanger as a hero of the women's movement. But in essence, she was not, because she indeed advocated practices which hurt women as well as men. After all, half of all births that are prevented, births that result in abortion, are women. Half of all abortions are women, and therefore certainly is not a friend of those people who value life.
Yes, well, a better way of putting that Planned Parenthood is embarrassed by her ideology and background is that they intentionally hide it and deceive the public. Because yeah, they promote her as a hero very energetically and unwaveringly and unabashedly, and still have a Margaret Sanger's award, and in fact Hillary Clinton very proudly accepted that award among other people. But this woman, it's amazing how people either are ignorant of this fact or are just unwilling to accept it. And it's amazing also that you very, very rarely hear about this in the media. You hear it mentioned once in a while, but not even on Fox News or some conservative media outlets. You hardly ever hear that this woman was an avowed racist. She had Nazis writing for her periodicals prior to World War II. In fact, it's interesting that I have heard that that Nazi Germany and Hitler himself learned much about eugenics from Long Island, New York, where I am from, because of the eugenics laboratory there. Have you heard of this eugenics laboratory?
Yeah, Cold Spring Harbor, yeah.
Yeah, I was raised about a half hour from Cold Spring, maybe 25 minutes from Cold Spring Harbor. And that laboratory still exists, but it is not a eugenics laboratory. And if you go to their website and you do some tricks here and there, it's not easy to find, but you can find some articles on their dark history where they openly are ashamed of that aspect of their background, saying nothing of abortion, of course.
Yeah.
And tell our listeners a little bit more about eugenics, because they hear this word and it's just kind of perhaps flying over their heads.
Yeah, eugenics, the main aspect that we focused on today for a number of reasons is elimination of the Jews. And they thought the Jews was a race, inferior race. And we tend to forget the fact that it wasn't just the Jews, but it was Gypsies, it was what they call Romani, it was Ukrainians, it was Slavics, it was just about everybody except Aryans. And Aryans they define basically as German or Scandinavian. And so it would include Hispanics, it would include people from South America, it would include American Indians, it would include, pretty much the whole world population. And now Hitler realized, and his minions realized, that you're not going to be able to fight a war against 90% of the world's population. But they thought, we'll get the Jews first, then we'll get the Romani and the Gypsies, and then we'll get the Slavics, and the goal was to make slaves at first and eventually eliminate the Slavics. In fact, they killed more Slavic people, Poles specifically, than they did Jews. And so they had a world goal to eliminate what they thought were inferior races, and again, we find that today ludicrous. But we stress the Jews, which we should, but on the other hand, we should stress what the goals were, was clearly eugenics, clearly racism, and clearly many, many people besides the Jews. The Jews is only the first step, and that's because there's many Jews, of course, in Germany. And I should stress, it wasn't religion, it was specifically Jewish background. There were no small number of Lutheran ministers who were Jewish in background. Their father or mother or grandfather was Jewish, and these were sent to the camps as well. So they didn't care if you were a Lutheran minister. They didn't care what you believed. They didn't care if you were a Christian. They cared if you had a German-Jewish background, or just a Jewish background would do, actually. And that's what they looked at, and that's basically who they sent to the camps. So Lisa Meitner, for example, was a well-known professor, a well-known physicist who actually was very important in developing the atomic bomb. And she was an active Lutheran, a committed Lutheran, but her father was Jewish, and therefore she managed to get out. They told her, you know, you better leave because you're in line for the camps, and so she managed to leave before she could be killed. But she went to Sweden, and ironically, when she was in Sweden, was where they discovered the process which eventually led to the atomic bomb. And so ironically, many of the leading scientists that developed the atomic bomb were from Germany. And so if Hitler didn't have his war against the Jews, ethnic Jews, by the way, then probably Germany would have developed the atomic bomb. In fact, if you look at, well, Albert Einstein was German. He was important. Lisa Meitner, I just mentioned. Leo Szilard was important, and he was also a German Jew. He was Hungarian Jew. And so many of the leading scientists that ended up developing the atomic bomb were indeed German Jews, or at least had Jewish ethnicity, which was, of course, the concern of the Nazis. So in many ways, they cut their own foot off because they could have conquered the world if they would have let the scientists develop the atomic bomb. If they only didn't have a war against ethnic Jews, then they probably would have, and we now, instead of speaking English, we'd be speaking German.
Well, thank God for that we are not.
If we would have survived, by the way. He didn't. He objected to Americans because Americans intermixed so much with Indians and with so many other ethnic groups that Hitler thought the Americans were no longer pure enough Germans, and so therefore he was concerned about America because, well, we're Mongols, we're a mixture, and he wanted essentially pure German. Of course, that's ridiculous. There is no pure German. Germans have been intermixing with groups around them for centuries, so to find a pure German, in fact, Hitler himself, some evidence indicates that he was not a pure German. The evidence is, and this is, of course, controversial, but evidence is that he was fathered by a Rothschild, and that actually one of the Rothschilds was his father. And the indication is that he was fathered by that, and he, therefore, the belief is that he destroyed all the evidence. For example, where the area where he was born, where the gravestones and so on were, he made sure that was destroyed so that, indeed, they could not find any evidence of his paternity. So, and again, that's controversial, but I think there's some decent evidence that indeed indicates that he was fathered by a Rothschild, which was a Jew, and so he was hypocritical in his war against the ethnic Jews.
Yes, in fact, it's a matter of record. It's not even theory that there were even a number of Jews in the American Nazi Party, founded by George Lincoln Rockwell. Very strange phenomenon. Of course, they were not openly identifying themselves or revealing the truth about themselves, but even secular historians are aware of that fact. And of course, you have the fact that I have been utterly convinced that the Nazi Party, especially in its early stages, was rampant with homosexuals, active homosexuals, and of course you have Ernst Röhm being the most notorious, open, unashamed homosexual pederast, being one of the leaders in the earlier part of the Nazi Party's history.
Yeah, there are some books that claim that. I have them. I haven't read them yet, to be honest, but later on, of course, the problem was is that they had to replace the 20 million or so Germans that died in the army, and so concern later on became with homosexuality that indeed they were not having big families.
Right.
And so it's kind of mixed, like you brought out, it's kind of a mixed bag. And some claim, I'm not sure if this is true, but again, some claim that was true with Hitler. He never did marry until the day before he committed suicide. And his relationship with Eva Brown was pretty bad. He really mistreated her. In fact, there are quite a bit of evidence that he was grossly abusive toward her, but she stuck toward him toward the bitter end, and they ended up committing suicide together, of course. And you wonder why any woman would stick with a man who was so abusive and very, very problematic. And that's the one theory, at least. Of course, there's all kinds of theories about Hitler, and they're a dime a dozen, as they say. But indeed, I think that's one possibility among others, that indeed he himself was oriented toward that lifestyle.
We have RJ in White Plains, New York, who wants to know, does Alfred Kinsey fit into the mix of popular figures who are revered as heroes who were actually in many ways monsters who were affected by Darwinism?
Yeah, he does. He's a central person that converted basically Judeo-Christian morality in this country to the problem we have today, especially among certain minority groups where about 70% of their children are born out of wedlock. And if you read the story of Alfred Kinsey, it's really a problem because he exploited students, graduate students, other professors. He was very promiscuous with males and with females, and he filmed a lot of this, so we have photographs. In fact, we know that he had relations with many of his students, as well as many of his co-workers, many of his co-authors, and that's been very well documented. And today, there's in universities, for good reason, there's no way he could get away with what he did back then. But back then, if, in many ways, they were more liberal, or at least regarding this issue, and he was not only into promiscuous sexual behavior, but he was also into what we call sadomasochism. And his book, Sexuality of the Human Male and Sexuality of the Human Female, he documents this, his findings, but his findings were ludicrous because he interviewed a lot of inmates, he interviewed a lot of populations that indeed are not representative of the American population, and so his, scientifically, his work is not just worthless, but worse than worthless, and his lifestyle alone is pretty apparent, abhorrent, even to people today that recognize the abuse of women, especially in colleges, and that's why we have this movement to ensure that exploitation of women no longer occurs at colleges and universities, and they've developed some good rules which indeed prevent the abuse that occurred with Kinsey when Kinsey was younger. He died quite young. He had a lot of health problems, which doesn't surprise me, but his work was supposed to be scientific, but now we know today from re-evaluation of his work that it was anything but scientific. It was, like I say, worse than helpful. It was really irresponsible, the conclusions he came to. And if you just read his Sexuality in Human Male, you can understand that his data is totally, completely wrong and biased. But what he was trying to say was that if behavior which we consider abnormal is done by a large number of people, therefore it couldn't be abnormal, it must be normal. So he was trying to justify behavior which we then and today regard as abnormal. He was trying to justify this by data, by saying, well, 80% of us do it, so therefore it must be okay.
That's interesting. That's interesting because I organized a debate a number of years ago in Amityville, Long Island, New York, not far from the aforementioned Cold Spring Harbor Lab. And this was between David Silverman, the president, the current president of Madeline Murray O'Hare's American Atheists Organization, and my friend Dr. James R. White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. And the debate theme was, is the New Testament evil? And David Silverman was saying that morality, because he knew he had to in some way borrow from a Christian worldview to even have a concept of morality and good and evil. And so he basically admitted that in his worldview, whatever the majority of people are doing in any particular geographic region in any particular era of time, that is what is moral, and that is what is good. And he, so when Dr. White said to this Jewish atheist, David Silverman, so that if you were being walked through the gates of a death camp by Nazi soldiers, is the worst thing that you could possibly say about this event is that you find it personally objectionable. And he said, he admitted it. He said, yes, which was kind of a breathtaking part of the debate. But it shows you the insanity that this worldview leads to. Well, I want to make sure before we run out of time, and I know already that we definitely have to have you back, not only to continue a discussion of this book, but to delve into your other many books. And you have an open door here, as far as I'm concerned, if you're interested in coming back. But I want you to summarize what you most want to have etched in the hearts and minds of our listeners right now.
Well, the thing I want to stress is that the idea of Darwinism, and let me define that, is from the goo to you by way of the zoo. The idea of Darwinism, and it's a worldview, it's the way they see the world. There are major, major problems with that, and that idea has caused huge problems in our society, which I document in several of my books, not just Nazism, but also other problems like the free love movement and promiscuity movement and so on. And so we need to understand that this worldview, the way they see the world, has been a problem, and we need to look at the evidence. And I stress, I read about a book a week, so I try to be well-read. And what I'm saying is that in order to find out what reality is, in order to see reality, you have to read. Read both sides. Read what this person says, what that person says. And when you carefully evaluate both sides, you can see indeed that the facts clearly come in favor of one side and not other sides. And it's not functional for me to tell people which side I'm on, although I think that's pretty apparent from the interview. But on the other hand, when you look carefully at the evidence, I find most people who look carefully at the evidence, they, in the long run, they agree with me. And so many people I say, well, you got to look at this side. And they say, well, no, I'm not going to look at that side because I don't accept it. Well, look at the side and then make a judgment. No, why should I bother reading stuff I disagree with? Well, I read stuff I disagree with all the time, and doing that helps me understand that the side I support is indeed supported by the facts, and therefore I can be more confident of what I have to say and my conclusions because I've looked at both sides. I understand both sides. In fact, as a Christian, you have an advantage of looking at the other side because then you understand the evidence for Christianity, and you're not accepting it just because this is what you were told as a child. There's a book called book and a film called The Case for Faith, which is coming out soon. And that does a good job showing, I haven't seen the film yet, but I've read the book, does a good job indeed showing that Lee Strobel became a Christian as a result of the facts that he learned by his research. And he was an atheist at one time. His wife challenged him. And he, through doing the research, he indeed saw that indeed the case for Christ is solid. And that's what the film is about, which I haven't seen yet, but I plan to soon. So I'd encourage your readers, if they're viewers, if they're listeners, if they're not a reader, well, to be a reader, and if you just aren't, then at least watch the film.
Well, I want to quickly, because you mentioned Lee Strobel, I just want to plug another conference. Lee Strobel is not going to be at it, but he is making public promotions for it. He is enthusiastically supporting the conference. And that is the New York Apologetics Conference at the Smithtown Christian School in Suffolk County, Long Island, New York. This is under the theme, Will You Survive the Culture? And the speakers include Greg Kokel, Frank Turek, and Mary Jo Sharp. That's the Dare to Defend conference being orchestrated by New York Apologetics. My friend Anthony Uvinio and his colleague Nick Mitchell are running this conference. And if you want to attend this conference, which is Friday, April 28th, 7 to 9 p.m., and Saturday, April 29th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., go to newyorkapologetics.com, newyorkapologetics.com, and that's New York. Those two words are spelled out. Do not abbreviate them. newyorkapologetics.com. I want to make sure that our listeners have the Joshua Press website. It's joshuapress.com. JoshuaPress.com, who have published this book that we have been discussing. Do you have any other contact information that you care to provide, Dr. Bergman?
Well, if my home email is jerrybergman30@yahoo.com. If any readers want to, listeners want to email me, that's fine, and I can help them with whatever concerns they have. jerrybergman30@yahoo.com. That's my home email, and that's where I try to deal with things that are related to my interest in this area.
Amen. And I want everybody to have a safe, joyful, and glorious Easter weekend. And I hope you have a blessed time at your Good Friday services if you are attending them. I want you all to always remember for the rest of your lives that Jesus Christ is a far greater Savior than you are a sinner.